political power to get bailed out. Well, what we need is clarity.
Let's have a look at some of the things that we do now in analogous kinds of situations. I guess they're not totally, but I'm thinking of things like the EQC, right? So we have a big fund, or ACC, because we know we have work accidents. So what do? We set up a big fund that invests in equities. It tries to make enough money to pay out when those things happen. Are we heading towards a situation where we need a climate change sovereign wealth fund that can pay out in future?
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because we haven't yet mentioned a really important issue with regard to this, and that's intergenerational justice. Right, so all of the examples we've talked about so far, some poor slob is bearing the entire burden of the industrial age on their backs as the person who might have their property use extinguished. That's obviously unfair. It's also obviously unfair to transfer the whole risk of climate change to the future and to leave our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren with an enormous burden that we did nothing to mitigate. So I do think we're obliged to think about spreading this risk not only across the country but across generations.
The Productivity Commission recently said that helping councils adapt to climate change was at the top of its list of urgent actions.
That was great that they said that. In the same report, they said, is it possible that we could just allow people to assume all of the risk associated with their property, which is a terrifying and ridiculous question?
We tend to focus on property, but actually a lot of people in areas like South Dunedin, for example, don't actually own property. They live there. They rent. And they live there because it's flat and accessible, and it's a community that they can live comfortably in. But if it is their landlords who are going to make the decisions about investing in that property, and one of the fears I have is that with incremental impacts from climate change, for example, and lowering property prices and maybe higher insurance costs, then landlords are much less likely to be investing in those properties and keeping them up. And so what we will get is a gradual development of a ghettoisation of areas where there's a lot of rental properties, or even just a few. So part of what we've got to think about is not just the rights and needs of property owners, but also the rights and needs of other people who live in those areas who could be equally or even worse impacted.
And I mean, South Dunedin, some of those communities must be getting to the point where you're thinking about whether it is sustainable to live there long term. I mean, we've had major flooding several times in the last few years there.
Yeah, I think we should not be using them, South Dunedin, as a place that we continually talk about with climate change. With a climate change hat on, there are many places in New Zealand that are being impacted in a whole variety of ways from climate. South Dunedin has got a very complex set of issues, and there's a lack of clarity about exactly what the trajectory of impact might be. We know there are impacts, but I would be very loath to say that they are.
Oh, for sure, they're not alone. Hutt City Council, they've reported that large parts of Petone could be underwater by the turn of the century. Yes, it's a long way away, but, you know, I mean, this is real stuff for people who are buying houses in the future for our children and grandchildren, isn't it? So what are these councils doing about this?
We need to make sure that we're not making these decisions simply based on market value. These communities have real value. And it would be a terrible mistake for us to say places like South Dunedin, we need to talk about managed retreat and wealthy cities with a big concentration of value. Of course, we're going to talk about hard engineering solutions. People who aren't property owners have real, measurable sociocultural value that the community seeks to protect.
Mm. And I'd like also just to say that, and Caroline started with this, is that coasts are actually part of all of our identities. We go there as children, we catch fish there, we play on the beach, we take our boats out on the water, we camp there. We have huge memories, probably all of us, about the beaches and places that we enjoyed. For your children and grandchildren, that could be really, really different. And so part of what concerns me about these impacts is actually an erosion of kind of an identity about what it is to be a Kiwi, in fact, because our coast could look really, really different in 50 years' time. So it's not just a financial issue. It's a very, very complex issue that doesn't just affect the people who live in those places and own properties in those places now. It affects every one of us as New Zealanders.
I'm going to open this up for questions very shortly, and I see we've already got a couple of hands going up, which is great. But I did want to, not in a naive way, but I wanted to finish with some degree of what we can do, and I didn't want it to be only a negative conversation, because it's frightening in some ways, isn't it? This is scary stuff. So what are the hints of optimism? What are the things that we can do? How can we, if at all, be positive about this?
I see so many positives in the work that we've been doing recently with really strong communities who are seeking to coalesce around climate adaptation, but also a number of other issues to build resilience in their communities. And it might be that they would like to build their identity through festivals or food or energy, you know, transforming their communities into the future. And there are really strong voices in some of these communities. They're positive, strong leaders, and they're seeking agency so that they're a voice for talking to councils.
Yeah, there are as many opportunities as there are possible policies. And I think one thing that we need to think about is the opportunity cost of not doing anything. The status quo is certainly not perfect. With our current dependence on automobility, something that everybody in Auckland understands, isolates us from each other and makes it more difficult for communities to have a say in the outcomes that affect them. It would be wonderful for us to undertake these changes around climate change and also get stronger ties to each other, less isolation from each other. We wouldn't be as fat, sick, and tired of commuting. There are many co-benefits that go along with all of this adaptation work.
The law is playing catch-up, but the law in New Zealand is extremely flexible. So there's no impediment to coming up with good legal frameworks to do whatever we want them to do. We just need to be talking about what we want them to do. So I'm pleased that we're talking about it. I was in New York a few weeks ago, and certainly the people at the conference were talking about it, but I'm not sure about parts of the rest of the country.
I have a sense of optimism that councils around New Zealand are really concerned and wanting to act in the interests of their citizens. And I have an optimism, as Caroline's already said, that communities are already starting to talk about this amongst themselves and are starting to look for opportunities to do really great stuff. And some of this really great stuff might not seem to have much to do with climate change, but it's about building resilience, and that's what we're going to need.
Time now for audience questions in this Otago University Symposium about how we are responding to the effects of climate change on our coastline.
So this may sound a bit silly, but I was wondering, what can normal people do to stop climate change?
There is so much to do, both personally and collectively. I think the most important thing that everyone can do is talk to their neighbors and their friends about it. Don't be isolated and don't despair. There are many other things.
Oh, well, I guess one thing is thinking about the way there are emissions. You know, when I'm talking about emissions, I'm saying if we're flying somewhere, we're releasing carbon into the atmosphere, and that's bad for climate change. So we need to consider the way we travel, and do we really need to go places? Can we do stuff actually by not traveling? So as an academic, all of us travel probably way too much. Can we substitute some of that travel for other things? I mean, these days I spend most of my life on Zoom, which is like an online way of seeing people on the screen and talking that way, and that's cutting down heaps of travel. So for me personally, I'm looking at the ways I can reduce the amount of air travel that I do.
I'll just tell you two or three things that I think are really important. One of them is actually to eat a whole lot less meat, because eating less meat is the single biggest impact you can have in your personal life, unless you are a big flyer. If you fly internationally or to Perth or to the UK, you're blowing your greenhouse gas emissions out of the water. It's three or four times your household's emissions for a year. So that's two big things. And I see a number of grey hairs around this room here. You've probably got investments. Think about where your money's invested. Can you talk to your superannuation scheme and say, I want to divest from fossil fuels and invest in positive alternatives. So there's three things.
My suggestion would be to dream. I think humans are amazingly inventive, and I think that there may be solutions out there that haven't even been thought of. So to someone of your age, I'd say just dream big.
Be the next Greta Thunberg.
I'd like to thank my guests, Associate Professor Janet Stevenson, Dr. Carolyn Orchiston, Dr. Ben France Hudson, and Professor Lisa Ellis. These Otago University experts have been discussing how we are responding to the effects of climate change on our coastline. In the chair, I'm Guyan Espiner for RNZ.